In the year 539 BC, profound change was suddenly taking place in the ancient world. Up to that point, Babylon, which was founded about 2300 BC, and that is over 4,300 years ago, and was the oldest of all human empires and the most powerful on the face of the earth up until that time. For instance, the city of Babylon, probably at its height, had a population of 200,000 people or more. The walls of the city measured 60 miles, and I don't know if it was totally circular or rectangular or a perfect square. Archaeology hasn't defined that, but we do know that it was 60 miles in length, probably about 15 miles on each side. 80 feet tall. The walls around the city of Babylon were 80 feet tall. Think about that. Man was brutal back then. Had walls to protect the city. 80 feet high, but 300 feet thick. Oh, wait a minute. I'm sorry. I got that mixed up. They were 80 feet wide and 300 feet tall. The walls of the city of Babylon. Think of that as a monumental engineering feat. The walls were so thick that it said that two chariots could ride on the inside walls, bypassing one another in opposite directions. Pretty impressive. 250 guard towers, or about one every mile or so, watched over the city day and night. In the days of the height of its military and economic power, it would have been difficult to believe how quickly this powerful nation, you could call it a city-state, the most ancient of all kingdoms on the earth, how could it fall? But it did. In 539 BC. The Persians ingeniously developed a strategy of going under the gates of the river Euphrates. But not only that, upstream from the river, they were able to divert the river to stop the flow. So think about, speaking of slavery, thinking about how many people were probably virtual slaves to divert a river of that magnitude so that they could creep in the middle of the night and actually overthrow Babylon, the city, at that time. It was Cyrus who did that, whether he entered the city himself or whether his invading hordes did, and took over the city, took over the kingdom, and became the next world-ruling kingdom, is unknown, at least by me. But at that particular time, there was an edict by this individual, who is, by the way, prophesied to be born in Isaiah, I believe it's chapter 45. An edict by Cyrus allowed any of the Jews who had been taken in the previous captivity, various ones, three different deportations, that would allow them to return if they wanted to Jerusalem. And some did. Turn to Zechariah chapter 4 and verse 10. Zechariah 4:10. It says, "Who has despised the day of small things?" This chapter describes the prophet Zechariah receiving a vision from an angel. It is a vision that is intended to show the most important aspect of power, God's power, God's spirit, not human might. That is the most important aspect of this chapter that was to be impressed upon the prophet. And he would be so impressed by that statement that he would give that message to the people of his day, or more specifically, to the leaders of that day. It is very easy to get bogged down in the here and now of life. Where do we go from here? What's going to happen next? I was thinking earlier this week about the over 30 years of being in Tucson, and even before that, my attendance at the Feast of Tabernacles since 1972, when there were about 3,000 people from all over Europe and England who were keeping the Feast of Tabernacles in Minehead, England. And I knew at that time that in Pennsylvania, my brother would be going to the feast, and they would have 14,000 people keeping the feast at the Poconos, probably 12,000 keeping the feast in the Wisconsin Dells in 1972, and maybe another 14,000 in Lake of the Ozarks, not Branson, Lake of the Ozarks, Missouri, as many of you know, with one lane in, one lane out of that facility. And then people in Squaw Valley, probably a couple of thousand at the ice arena there. And at various places, Big Sandy, probably in 1972, Terry was there. There would have been another 14,000 or so. People camped, if you're familiar with the campus or the old campus, people camped on the opposite side of Lake Loma, which was a man-made lake named after Loma Armstrong. And altogether, there were 80 to 90,000 people around the world at that time, and then it would escalate to a peak of about 140 to 150,000 people keeping the Feast of Tabernacles, and that was a big deal to us. It was huge. And as I mentioned last week, some of the traditions that we all were enamored with and some of the things that we were very excited about many years ago when we had many more people keeping the Feast of Tabernacles, the little green bumper stickers on your car. If you've been born in recent years, or if you've been born since like 1995 or so, you really, that doesn't mean anything to you. But to your parents and your grandparents, it means a lot. Because you would excitedly remember as a kid, as Terry did, seeing on the back roads of Texas, maybe on the interstates, elsewhere throughout the United States, in Pennsylvania or Wisconsin or California or wherever the feast was being kept, you would spy a bumper sticker. Somebody with a green bumper sticker, and you'd say, "That's my church. Those are my people." It's not like that now. No more green bumper stickers, no more excitement on the highways, at least for our kids. But you might see some people on your way and your journey, and you'll recognize them as church members, and that'll be the same thing. If you're going to Rapid City, if you're going to Utah, if you're going to Texas, or if you're going to Florida, or anywhere else that God's people are keeping the Feast of Tabernacles, that will be some consolation. And there'll be a tremendous amount of consolation when you get in that room, no matter how far you have to be apart from people and whether they're wearing masks or whether they're not. Those are God's people, and you're going to have fun. From this lesson of ancient history, we'll get more into this, we are assured of the future. What are the greater lessons, or what are some of the greater lessons of the Feast of Tabernacles that we can take into the rest of the fall holy day season? What are some of those lessons we can take into this time that we're about to celebrate, even though it's not huge like we thought it was back way back when. The title is The Day of Small Things. In studying Bible subjects, I have found it good. Now, you may not, okay? But I have found it good to keep in mind the general time frame. And I think that's good. Now, my brother Hugh, hi Hugh, if you're watching, and Bonnie, he has developed a chronology that is on a spreadsheet, and Steve Walden figured out that if we printed out that spreadsheet, it would take up like 300,000 pages or something. So it is an incredible chronology that goes back to the time of Adam. I will say, Hugh, if you're listening, I did not consult the chronology when I was putting this sermon together. I consulted my memory and a few books. It's not the last word on the subject. The last word on the subject is my brother's chronology. But he's done a very good job. So the dates I give are general, probably within a year or two, certainly within a decade. But I think they're pretty close to being pretty accurate. But who really knows? Who knows if everything on Hugh's chronology is exactly right? There are some problems with Bible chronology from time to time. But I do know this. As I said, I think it's good to keep in mind a general timeline and to have that in mind and to be a little bit consistent if you're a year off there. But remember, okay, there's a 70-year period here, blah, blah, blah. So just as long as you get to 70 years later, et cetera, you get the point. So many of us read in the original United States and British Commonwealth in prophecy, we remember the years 605 through 585, a period of 20 years, basically. So if those years are not accurate, if it's 603 to 587, or if it's 607 to 585 or 7, if the fall of the temple was 587 BC, if it was razed to the ground then by the Babylonians, you're in the ballpark, okay? You're in the ballpark. You're not in the stadium parking lot. You're in the ballpark if you're around those time frames. And you have to remember that because the Jews were carried away from their homeland in Judah and Jerusalem in three successive deportations. Many of the elites and the leaders, ones who might become prophets later on, were carried in that first wave. 605, 603, you're in the ballpark, okay? Most of us have probably read about that for the first time in our lives when we picked up that booklet from the Worldwide Church of God written by Herbert Armstrong. And I think that all of the churches of God in the various permutations have written a similar work that follows that general guideline and follows that historical perspective, and it's important to all of us. But none of us are the owners of that. God is the owner of that history. God is the owner of what happened. But if I haven't read any of the others, I've read the original work, I've read our current work in United Church of God, and there are other churches that have written. I can't wholesale acknowledge to you that they're all right down on the money like the original or like ours or whatever, but I'm sure they're fairly close. They're in the ballpark, probably. The history of Israel and Judah is not something that is mentioned in world history classes that much. And much of world history is not mentioned in the Bible because the history in the Bible has to do with Israel and the nations that they came into contact with. That's what the Bible is about. But as far as history classes, most of you didn't study in your world history classes much about Judah and Israel, because most people think they're one and the same. They're exactly the same, or they just call it the Jews, and they're done with that. But let me ask you this. How many Jews were carried away to Babylon? We don't know. The Bible doesn't tell us. We don't know. We can only guess. But I think sometimes in a case like this, it's probably good to guess in a way. Probably good to come to some assumptions to give you an idea of the scale of that time. Probably because of the problems of the day, the general confusion of the nation that was being besieged by Babylon on various occasions throughout a 20-year period, and a lack of record keeping that was preserved, we are not given an exact count. In 2 Chronicles chapter 14, and verse 8, we read about one of the more righteous kings of Judah's history. Second Chronicles chapter 14 and verse 8. Now Asa, King Asa of Judah, the nations were divided. Judah was separate from the 10 tribes at this time. Asa ruled from about 908 to 867 BC. This is about 300 years before the Jews were carried away into captivity. God dealt with them over that period of time through various prophets. But Asa was one of the more righteous of the kings of Judah. And it says in verse 8 that Asa had an army of 300,000 from Judah, and from Benjamin, 280,000 men who carried shields and drew bows. In all these were mighty men of valor. So his army was pretty big by ancient or modern standards, almost 600,000 men of war. I guess they would be at least 20 years and up. It wouldn't account for all of the men. And I think that my estimates are probably on the conservative side, but if you just take a factor, which I think is very conservative, of multiplying that number by 3 or 4, because it doesn't account for the older men or even the younger men, but looking at it by a factor of 3 to 4, you probably come up to at least, and this is, I think, is on the conservative side, the nation at that time of Judah and Benjamin, probably about 2 to 3 million overall, not in Jerusalem, but overall. That would be my guess. Now, I may be wrong, and we can talk about that later. But Asa was one of the more righteous kings of Judah. And in chapter 15, we read, "Now the Spirit of God came upon Azariah, the son of Oded. And he went out to meet Asa and said to him, 'Hear me, Asa, and all Judah and Benjamin. The Lord is with you while you are with him. If you seek him, he will be found by you. But if you forsake him, he will forsake you. For a long time, Israel has been without the true God, without a teaching priest, and without law.'" This is the kingdom that Asa inherited from his previous, from his predecessor, Abijah. Verse 4, But when in their trouble they turned to the Lord their God of Israel and sought him, he was found by them. And in those times there was no peace to the one who went out, nor to the one who came in, but great turmoil was on all the inhabitants of the lands." Almost sounds kind of like some of our modern cities today in some cases. So nation was destroyed by nation and city by city, for God troubled them with every adversity. "But you be strong and do not let your hands be weak, for your work shall be rewarded." And when Asa heard these words and the prophecy of Oded the prophet, he took courage and removed all the abominable idols from all the land of Judah and Benjamin and from the cities which he had taken in the mountains of Ephraim. And he restored the altar of the Lord that was before the vestibule of the Lord. That would be in the temple. Then he gathered all Judah and Benjamin, those who dwelt with them from Ephraim, Manasseh, and Simeon, for they came over to him in great numbers from Israel when they saw that the Lord his God was with them. Even some members from the 10 tribes came to Asa, and they didn't just come because of his magnetic personality. They came because when Asa turned his heart to God, things changed in the nation for the better. And people see that. It probably developed over a period of time. People saw what was happening in Judah, and some from the other tribes came. So they gathered together at Jerusalem in the third month in the 15th year of the reign of Asa. And they offered to the Lord at that time 700 bulls and 7,000 sheep from the spoil they had brought. And then they entered in a covenant to seek the Lord God of their fathers with all their heart and with all their soul. And whoever would not seek the Lord God of Israel was to be put to death, whether small or great, whether man or woman. They took things really seriously at that particular time. Then they took an oath before the Lord with a loud voice, with a shouting of trumpets and ram's horns. And Judah rejoiced at the oath, for they had sworn with all their heart and sought him with all their soul, and he was found by them. And the Lord gave them rest all around. There was peace in the land, probably not since it happened over 100 years prior, during the time of the reign of Solomon in the United Kingdom. So Asa was one of the righteous kings, and he did some good things. In verse 16, it says, also he removed Maachah, the mother of Asa the king, from being queen mother. You know, they borrowed that from the Babylonians, from other nations. And that had been because she had made an obscene image of Ishtar, Ashtoreth. And Asa cut down her obscene image. Let your imagination help you to understand what that could have been. And then crushed it and burned it by the brook Kidron. So they did good. They removed these obscene images, obelisks, very likely. And a nation prospered. But there was some compromise. If you follow God, go in the entire way. That's the lesson of Judges. That's the lesson from the life of Asa. Did so much good, but kind of stopped short of being perfect, because in verse 17, but the high places were not removed from Israel. Nevertheless, the heart of Asa was loyal all his days. He did the best he could, what he thought he could, and he compromised a little bit, not so good. He also brought into the house of God the things that his father had dedicated and that he himself had dedicated, silver and gold and utensils. And there is no war until the 35th year of the reign of Asa. So he reigned a good long time. And there was peace, and Judah was at peace. But throughout the next 300 years, things would go downhill, little by little. Now, there were other righteous kings of Israel, or Judah. There were no righteous kings of Israel. Take a look through the entire history of Israel, the 10 tribes. There was not one righteous king among them. None certainly like Asa. Isaiah, Micah, Jeremiah, Zephaniah, many others were sent to the kings of Judah to no avail. And it was to those individuals that Jesus mentioned to the Pharisees and the Sadducees, you're just like your fathers who rejected the prophets of old. And of course, that didn't make them very happy. We'll skip ahead to 2 Chronicles chapter 34. In 2 Chronicles chapter 34 through 35, we read of another religious revival under another righteous king by the name of Josiah. And in chapter 34 of 2 Chronicles, in verse 1, this king was only 8 years old when he ascended to the throne. What are you going to know as an 8-year-old? Almost nothing. So you have advisors. You've got people that are mature, people that guide you. You can't reign as an 8-year-old. That is an impossibility. So you have people helping you. I'm filling in the gaps here. Some opinion, some speculation, but the nation isn't held together by somebody that's 8 years old. Come on, let's get serious. It wasn't uncommon in the ancient world for somebody to ascend to the throne because a father or a grandfather died. But let's be realistic. A nation of 2, 3, 4 million people not going to be properly governed by an 8-year-old. So Josiah was 8 years old when he became king, and he reigned 31 years in Jerusalem. He also had a good long reign. And he did what was right in the sight of the Lord and walked in the ways of his father David. So he's descended from David. He did not turn aside to the right hand or to the left. When he was 16 years old, this is rare, but it does happen, as we know. In the 8th year of his reign, while he was still young, he went down to the Department of Motor Vehicles and he got his driver's license. He could not vote and he could not drink, but he could drive a chariot. He was 16 years old. You know, I couldn't wait to get my license at 16. How about you? It's kind of a rite of passage, isn't it? But entrusting an automobile to a 16-year-old boy is a very risky proposition. I'm hitting both sides here, parents. With the right teaching, though, they can do it. But you have to be very careful. Okay, enough of that. He was 16 years old. He began to seek the God of his father David, and in the 12th year of his reign, he began to purge Judah. So when he was 20, he began to purge Judah and Jerusalem of the high places, the wooden images and the carved images and the molten images. Get rid of them. They broke down the altars of the Baals in his presence and the incense altars. He still couldn't vote in this country. Yeah, he could. Well, wait a minute. He was 2 years, yeah. I don't know why they give 18-year-olds the right to vote, you know. Just like, why did they give women the right to vote? You know, who knows? Just, now, that's a joke, okay? All right. Losing half the audience. He was 20 years old. It's a sign of maturity in the Bible. And boy, oh boy, did he enact some reforms which were spectacular for the time. Because, you see, Judah and Israel before them, they hadn't done what they were supposed to do 500 years earlier when they came into the land. And that is get rid of all of the foreign peoples and get rid of all of their gods and all of their high places. And you can find that in Judges 1 and 2. And you can see them being reprimanded for not following through on the command that God had given to them. And now it's still plaguing them hundreds of years later. And so they broke down the altars of the Baals in his presence and the incense altars which were above them. He cut down the wooden images, the carved images, the molded images he broke in pieces, made dust of them, scattered it on the graves of those who had sacrificed to them. Wow. Pulverized them. Probably burned them, took the dust. He also burned the bones of the priests on their altars and cleansed Judah and Jerusalem. And so he did in the cities of Manasseh, Ephraim, and Simeon, as far as Naphtali, and all around with axes. You talk about being on a mission. Josiah was on a mission. When he had broken down the altars and the wooden images, had beaten down the carved images into powder and cut down all the incense altars throughout all the land of Israel, he returned to Jerusalem. Incredible work. And in the 18th year of his reign, verse 8, when he had purged the land and the temple, he sent Shaphan, the son of Azaliah, Maaseiah, the governor of the city, and Joah, the son of Johaz, the recorder, to repair the house of the Lord his God. Now, he did all of this And I'm not sure if he was encouraged by prophets or what else, but notice what happens else. In verse 9, when they came to Hilkiah the high priest, they delivered the money that was brought into the house of God, which the Levites who kept the doors had gathered from the hand of Manasseh and Ephraim, from all the remnant of Israel, from all Judah and Benjamin, which they had brought back to Jerusalem. And when they put it in the hand of the foreman who had the oversight of the house of the Lord, they gave it to the workmen who worked in the house of the Lord to repair and restore the house. It had fallen into some disrepair. They gave to the craftsmen and the builders to hew stone and timber for beams. A lot of maintenance and upkeep had been neglected in the temple of God for a long time, and to floor the houses which the kings of Judah had destroyed. And the men did work faithfully, their overseers, etc., etc., skillful people, etc., etc. Now, in verse 14, now when they brought out the money that was brought into the house of the Lord, Hilkiah the priest found the book of the law of the Lord given by Moses. They discovered the scrolls. They discovered the law of God. And verse 16, they carried the book to the king, bringing the king word, saying, all that was committed to your servants they have doing. In verse 19, we'll skip ahead to there. Thus it happened, when the king heard the words of the law, that he tore his clothes. Now exactly how he enacted all the reforms is not mentioned here in Chronicles. Probably given some instruction by the prophets. But then when he was able to hear the book of the law read and explained to him, he repented. In verse 21, he said, go inquire the Lord for me and for those that are left in Israel and Judah concerning the words of the book that is found. For great is the wrath of the Lord that is poured out on us, because our fathers have not kept the word of the Lord to do according to all that is written in this book. And so another purge took place. Another great reformation in a religious sense took place when they found the law, when they read the law, when they took it to heart. And in verse 35, it says, in verse 1, now Josiah kept a Passover to the Lord in Jerusalem, and they slaughtered the Passover lambs at the 14th day of the first month. They did everything according to the law. And in verse 19, it says, in the 18th year of the reign of Josiah, this Passover was kept. He was still only 26 years old at that time. Ascended to the throne at 8, and in his 18th year, he's 26. Did an incredible job. And you can read some of these chapters and fill in some of the gaps for yourself. I think it's a good idea. But in verse 20, in verse 20 of chapter 35, it said, and after all this, when Josiah had prepared the temple, Necho, king of Egypt, came to fight against Carchemish by the Euphrates, and Josiah went out against him. Now, he didn't have to, apparently. The king of Egypt wasn't coming after him, but he had done all this great work. And he decided to go fight against the king of Egypt. And he was warned by messengers, what have I to do with you, king of Judah? I have not come against you this day, but against the house with which I have war. The Battle of Carchemish is one of those things that might be covered in world history. For God commanded me to make haste, refrain from meddling with God who is with me, lest he destroy you. Maybe a little truth, maybe a little braggadocio, but the end result is that Josiah didn't turn back and he was killed in battle by the archers. Now, he did a lot of good. It's a shame that he died just shortly after he turned 26, and he was doing so much good for the nation. In the last chapter of 2 Chronicles, we find the demise of this nation leading to that which I had previously begun with, the fall of Judah and Jerusalem, which took place over a 20-year period, and the remaining kings that are mentioned. Here's something interesting in 2 Chronicles chapter 36 and verse 9. Mentions somebody that was installed in the throne after several others. There was one after rapid succession, after another, people killed and all that. You can read that. But one was brought to the throne by the name of Jehoiakim. He was also 8 years old. This was about, we're in the ballpark, 597 B.C. And if you've taken a look at the timeline that I previously gave you, that would be kind of in the middle of this time in which three different deportations of the Jews took place to Babylon, or the modern nation of Iraq today. 8 years old, this individual is also called in the Bible Jeconiah. He was also carried off to Babylon, as it describes here. Jehoiakim, or Jeconiah, had a son. The name of that son was Shealtiel. And he had a son. Now, there's some minor controversy as to whether or not he really had a son, or did he die and his brother, as the biblical command, marry the widow and have a son in his name. It's a possibility. But don't get tied up with that, because he is in the lineage of Jesus Christ that you'll find in the New Testament. So Jehoiakim, or Jeconiah, 8 years old, royalty, carried off by Nebuchadnezzar to Babylon. We don't read too much of him. Now let's turn ahead to the book of Ezra. Ezra chapter 3. Remember I said Shealtiel had a son. Shealtiel was the son of Jeconiah. And he had a son. Now in Ezra chapter 3, we're skipping ahead after the captivity. Jeconiah taken into captivity, taken to Judah. He was 8 years old, about 597 B.C. But now, in about 539 B.C., his grandson appears on the scene. Ezra 3:1, and when the seventh month had come and the children of Israel were in the cities, the people gathered together as one man to Jerusalem. They were going to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. Then Joshua, the son of Jozadak, and his brethren, the priests, and Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and his brethren arose and built the altar of the God of Israel to offer burnt offerings on it, as it is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. Now, reading between the lines and looking through all of these spaces in history, it's almost amazing to think of the fact that people could go far away from God, and yet an ancient scroll could be found in the temple that had been neglected, and people absolutely begin to read it and say, what have we done? As Josiah did. And there'd be a religious revival that the entire nation would follow after. And then later on, over 70 years later, after the fall of the temple, a grandson of a, you know, let's face it, just a little bit more than an infant king who was carried away to Babylon in captivity could be returned and be one of the ones under 43,000 who returned to Jerusalem to help with this process of rebuilding the temple. Though fear, verse 3, though fear had come upon them because of the people of those countries, they set the altar on its basis and they offered burnt offerings on it to the Lord, both the morning and the evening burnt offerings. They also kept the Feast of Tabernacles, as is written, and offered the daily burnt offerings in the number required by ordinance for each day. Afterwards, they offered the regular burnt offering and those for the new moons and for all the appointed feasts of the Lord that were consecrated, and those of everyone who willingly offered a freewill offering to the Lord. From the first day of the seventh month, they began to offer burnt offerings to the Lord, although the foundation of the temple of the Lord had not been laid. The time period is mentioned in the beginning of the book of Ezra. In chapter 1 and verse 1, it says, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia. And that would be 539 B.C. And there is a genealogy that is mentioned of all the people and the number of those who came back. You know, who would have come back from a comfortable life in Babylon? It's obvious that the Jews flourished in Babylon, and they weren't abject slaves in many cases. They cried by the rivers of Babylon, obviously. There's a beautiful psalm in that regard. But they adjusted. And it's obvious that they set up schools in which their language was taught, in which they learned of the law of God, and somehow or another the law was preserved so that they could learn it and obey it. Then Cyrus, who is prophesied before he was born to come on the scene, made this edict. If any of you want to go back, we're going to give you everything to take to the house of God that you can build. And you can build it. And guess who shows up as one of the ones? Joshua, who is a priest, and Zerubbabel, who is a descendant of the line of the kings of Judah. Incredible. I would think that it would take some pretty brave people. Now, again, we don't know how many people were carried away to Babylon, if it was in the millions or the hundreds of thousands, because obviously some people would have been killed in battles before they were ever begun the deportation to Babylon. It could have been hundreds of thousands of people, but only just less than 43,000 came back. They'd have to be of pretty solid stock, people that were pioneers, people that weren't afraid of a challenge. So we just don't know how many were carried away, but we know that a lot of people a lot of the Jews stayed in Babylon and then became a part of what the world knows as the diaspora. Chapter 3 of Ezra shows a very joyous time, a festive time, and also a sad time. It perhaps kind of a parallel to us in a way. We're looking forward to the feast as a joyous time, a festive time, and, you know, kind of, wow, it's not what it used to be. Not exactly. Until we remember that that's not what it's all about. In verse 12, many of the priests and the Levites and the heads of the fathers' houses, old men who had seen the first temple, wept with a loud voice when the foundation of this temple was laid before their eyes. You know, the foundation of the temple had been raised by Nebuchadnezzar. Everything was torn down, but they got together and somehow, with a lot of work and hard work and effort, the foundation of the temple was laid again with these massive stones. And a lot of people rejoiced. The temple was only just begun. In verse 13, so that the people could not discern the noise. Okay, I missed something. It said, some wept with a loud voice, middle of verse 12, when the foundation of this temple was laid before their eyes, yet many shouted aloud for joy. So that the people could not discern the noise of the shout of joy from the noise of weeping of the people, for the people shouted with a loud shout, and the sound was heard afar off. Sure that the weeping was tears of joy, maybe of frustration, maybe of the realization of what had happened 70 years prior to that time, and what led them all and their families and their ancestors to be taken off into captivity. And that realization. But the foundation was laid. Chapter 4, boy, oh boy, whenever something gets going, you have adversaries. And so there were adversaries that came. And to make a long story short, the building of the temple was stopped. Stopped cold. Foundation laid, everything else put to rest because of an adversarial group of people. And you know what? You read through this, a couple of guys' names are mentioned as those who were the adversaries. In verse 1 of chapter 4, it says, "Now when the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that descendants of the captivity were building the temple of the Lord God of Israel, they came to Zerubbabel and the heads of the fathers' houses and said, 'Let us build with you.'" Oh, yes, let us be a part too. "For we seek your God as you do, and we have sacrificed to him since the days of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, who brought us here." Yeah, those were the people who would later become the Samaritans. They were not Israelites. "Hey, we love your God. We don't sacrifice to Baal anymore. We still have his image, but we call him your God. You know, that's what we do." So it's not just a couple of guys that showed up. I'm sure it were thousands of these Samaritans that came in openly opposing. And the people of Judah said, "Nope, Zerubbabel and Joshua," verse 3, "we don't have anything to do with you. Get out. Get out of town by sundown or else." And so the next few chapters of this book deal with the problems and the problems of the temple of God being stopped. Now, why was the temple so important? Because Jesus would come to it. It had to be ready for him 500 years later. It had to be a point of instruction for the people of Judah. It simply had to exist. God allows adversaries at times. So the building was stopped until the reign of Darius, king of Persia, where they had to go back into the records, and you read through this book and read through the book of Nehemiah, and you're going to find that they had to go back through the record and say, "Yeah, everything's up to speed here. That's what Cyrus had said. So we'll let them begin." So they began again in 520 BC. 15, 16 years later. So now, let's turn to Ezra chapter 6. Skipped over a couple of chapters. You can read that. This brings us to the edict of King Darius. In researching all of their records, and their record keeping was very good, and they allowed that to happen. And in verse 14, "So the elders of the Jews built, and they prospered through the prophesying of Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the son of Iddo. And they built and finished it according to the commandment of God of Israel, according to the command of Cyrus, Darius, and Artaxerxes, king of Persia." The temple was now complete. About 515 B.C. So we've come down 85 years from 600 B.C., which is about in the middle of all of these deportations, and 85 years later, approximately, it was all done. And the rest of the chapter talk about the Passover and the days of unleavened bread being kept during those days, about 515 B.C. Now, chapter 7, you got to fast forward about 55 years later, because although the temple was built, the walls in the city of Jerusalem had not yet been completed. So go by about 55 more years into the future, and an individual by the name of Ezra, who is a part of the Babylonian captivity, is mentioned in chapter 7. As I mentioned, schools in Babylon for the Jews had flourished. The Jews kept their identity because they realized that they had forsaken the Sabbath and the holy days, and yet that's what led them to captivity. But in the captivity, they realized where they had gone wrong. And Ezra was an incredible individual And he wanted to go back to Jerusalem from Babylon. Verse 10 of chapter 7, it says, "For Ezra had prepared his heart to seek the Lord, the law of the Lord, and to do it, and to teach statutes and ordinances in Israel." And now the king of Persian kingdom was Artaxerxes, or the one that we know of in the Bible as the husband of Esther, Ahasuerus. Artaxerxes gave him a letter so he'd go back and do everything that he wanted. And he did. But what did he find when he got to Jerusalem? In chapter 8 and verse 24, he says, "And I separated 12 of the leaders of the priests, Sherebiah, Hashabiah, and 10 of their brethren with them, and weighed out to them the silver and the gold and the articles, the offering of the house of our God, which the king and his counselors and his princes and all Israel who were present had offered." I think I may have forgotten to put down the time period, but I think this is about 460 BC. Don't hold me to that. I'm thinking about the general time frame. But again, we're in the ballpark. In chapter 9, some of the restorations that were necessary, because again, a lot of time has lapsed now between the time of the original captivity, the return of the Jews, and the building of the temple, and the wall hadn't been finished around, the city hadn't been built. In verse 1 of chapter 9, "When these things were done, the leaders came to me, saying, 'The people of Israel and the priests and Levites have not separated themselves from the people of the lands.'" So you see, there are external pressures and internal pressures. You've got to correct both. And you can only be responsible, if you're a Jew, for the internal pressures that you have. And we are spiritual Jews. And years ago, when I first started in the church, kind of had a theme that was taught to us at Ambassador College for a number of reasons. And that theme is this, and I think it's a very good lesson. I'll just interject it, not in the notes or anything. When you have a responsibility, attend to that responsibility. That is an individual responsibility God gives to you. But if he doesn't give you that responsibility, don't always take it on your own to correct a situation. You may need to. It may become your responsibility. You can pray about it. But in those days, it was a matter of, I realized as a freshman, I wasn't the chancellor of the college. And therefore, no matter what I saw that might be wrong, it was not in my power to correct it. Now, I could suggest, but in those days, as a freshman, that would be kind of a death wish in the Church of God to do. But that is a ridiculous kind of example that I think gives you some of the intent of the principle of the instruction of, I guess you could say it's also like spiritually minding your own business. But when you have a responsibility in your family and yourself, pay attention to that. There are internal problems. There are external problems. Sometimes you can't do much about the external problems. All of these prophets and servants and priests, kings of God, found internal, external problems. Chapter 10. "Now while Ezra was praying, and while he was confessing, weeping, and bowing down before the house of God, a very large assembly of men, women, and children gathered to him, for the people wept very bitterly." There's always somebody else that believes the same way. And Ezra found that out. In verse 5, "Ezra rose and made the leaders of the priests, the Levites, and all Israel swear an oath that they would do according to this word." So they swore an oath. And on and on and on. This man was a restorer. In chapter 10, throughout that, you'll read about his restoration. Now, you have to jump ahead in the story to the book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah was a cupholder to King Ahasuerus, or Artaxerxes. And he realized, in this very responsible position, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, And Ezra had begun his work back in Jerusalem in the sixth year of King Artaxerxes. So 14 years later, Nehemiah, the king's cupbearer, said, you know, I want to go back to Jerusalem. There are things that need to be done. And he prayed about it, and he was fearful about it, and it shows you his attitude in chapter 2. And finally, he was allowed to go back by the king. The king granted his request. And what happened? This was about 446 B.C. The wall had been in ruins. Nehemiah had heard about it. He went back. And they completed the wall around Jerusalem in 52 days after he got back on the scene. Chapter 4 and verse 6. Opposition again. Opposition again and again and again and again by all these peoples that had been imported into the land by the Assyrians. In verse 4, Nehemiah 4, hear, O God, for we have despised, turned their reproach on our own heads, and given them as a plunder to a land of captivity. Do not cover their iniquity, and do not let their sin be blotted out from before you, for they have provoked you to anger before the builders. So we built the wall, and the entire wall was joined together up to half its height, for the people had a mind to work. Now it happened that when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, the Ashdodites heard that the walls of Jerusalem were being restored and the gaps were beginning to be closed, they became very angry. Yep, it always happens. But chapter 12 notes the dedication of that wall and the completion of that wall, and it was done about 444 B.C., from the beginning, the rebuilding of the temple, until the wall around the city was completed, was about 100 years. Think about that. That's slow in our time. 100 years. Brethren, what are some of the lessons you can take from these times? Because you can read more and more about what happened in chapter 12 and the times of thanksgiving and everything they did throughout the rest of this book. In verse 27, it shows that now at the dedication of the wall of Jerusalem, they sought out the Levites in all their places to bring them to Jerusalem to celebrate the dedication with gladness, both with thanksgivings and singings, with cymbals and stringed instruments and harps. And on it went. And they had a very festive occasion at that time. What are some of the lessons that you can take with you and think about as you keep the Feast of Tabernacles? I think it's obvious. Patience is one of them. Waiting on God is perhaps another. God's work sometimes faces external pressures is one. Sometimes it faces internal pressures, as within the people themselves, who need to be either straightened out or corrected. But I think one of the biggest lessons is that we have to hold on to the big picture, because all of these are little parts in a big, humongous puzzle. What is the big picture of all of this? Do you know what chapter of the Bible mentions the term Feast of Tabernacles more than any other? Well, I didn't. I'm not ashamed to admit it. I didn't until I looked it up. It's mentioned, that term is mentioned, what was it? I think it's about 8 times in the Bible, Feast of Tabernacles. Do you know what chapter mentions it the most? That is 3. I didn't. But we'll turn there now. It's in Zechariah. Zechariah chapter 14. This is really, really the big picture. And now we're going back in time to that edict by Darius that would change things and allow them to finish the temple. But now we flash, this was given during that time, but now we're flash forwarding into the future many, many years from then, and we don't know how many into the future from now as to when this event will happen. It shall come to pass that everyone who is left of all of the nations which came against Jerusalem shall go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. At various times through the history of Judah, after it was taken into captivity, you see the people of God keeping the Feast of Tabernacles, maybe not always knowing, we don't know exactly why they were doing it, but they did according to the instructions that they had at the time, and they were blessed. And it shall be that whichever of the families do not come up to Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, on them there will be no rain. That's in the future. After Christ's return, if the family of Egypt will not come up and enter in, then they shall have no rain. They shall receive the plague with which the Lord strikes the nations who do not come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. Never done in ancient times, plagues, no rain. But now things are different. And that tells you something. At this time, as it says, the earth is going to be filled with the knowledge of God. And in reality, there is no excuse for not going up to the Feast of Tabernacles when you're told point blank that you must go. Now, no one's telling you that now, right? You're doing this willingly. You want to go. So this is the nature of the plague that strikes the nations who do not come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. This shall be the punishment of Egypt and a punishment of all the nations that do not keep the Feast of Tabernacles. In Zechariah, pointing to Christ's return, right after his return, the Feast of Tabernacles will be kept. This doesn't mention a year, but it will be applicable in whatever year after Jesus returns. Whatever year. It's a conditional prophecy. Doesn't mean it has to happen, because if people obey, obviously there's going to be rain. There's not going to be plagues. It's a warning prophecy. When you go to the feast in a few days or the next week, remember that you, like many millions in the future, are going up to worship the King. Whatever the pressures, whatever the external forces, internal forces, little problems or difficulties of sight to sight or whatever, put all of that aside. You are going to worship the King who will be on this earth fairly soon. What we're doing, it's really on a small scale. It's small in comparison to this. Just like all of these examples and these types, these were small things leading up to this eventual conclusion, pointing us on to worshiping the King during the 1,000 years. Sometimes our problems are external, sometimes they are internal, but above all, remember the day of small things.